There we go, recording in progress. Okay, so this one's from Mary. Yes, Bob Thurman has said if you want to get a sense of your last life, look at your current body. If you want to know your next life, look at your mind. Yeah, so I'm gonna, this is a longer question. So I'm gonna just pause when it seems appropriate and run some commentary on it. This actually originally comes from Padmasambhava, where he said if you want to get a sense of your last life, look at your present conditions. If you want to get a sense of your future lives, look at your present actions. So this is Bob's kind of extrapolation of that. Okay, and also talk about how easy it is to find past life regression therapists. Okay, hasn't been all that easy to me. But hey, Bob knows more. He rolls in these circles more than I do. Yes, exactly. So this is the next part of your question, Mary. I have not found that easy. I agree. And I'm curious about my last life because I survived a traumatic fiddling vaginal breech delivery in a blizzard without an OB present. Jeez, yeah, that's intense. I'm curious if you're listening, how you know that. I mean, that's kind of cool. I always took it to mean I was very eager, needed to be here. But I'm curious how karma arranged such an entry. Despite being paralyzed for a time after the birth, I have no physical issues and a very healthy body. Yeah, so this is a loaded question. There's a ton here. The first thing is you cannot put all your eggs in the karmic basket. But you just can't do that. That's a subtle form of Eastern reductionism. Oh, everything's due to karma. It's not. It's not. And this is where the conflation comes in. This is where the problem is. Everything arises due to causes and conditions. Karma arises is basically the archetype of causes and conditions. And then there's the conflation, everything therefore must be karma. No, that's wrong. It's not. The Buddha himself, talked about it in one of the early Mahayana Hinayana Sutras when he talked about the five niyamas, the five orders. And these are worth just a very brief pinging out just to show you that karma niyama is just one of five. So, if I remember these properly, Uta Niyama, which is fundamentally what we know as physics, Bija Niyama, which is fundamentally what we know as biology, genetics, Chitta Niyama is basically what we know about mind, psychology, behavior, Dharma Niyama, which is basically the dharmic teachings that are applicable to this sort of thing, and then Karma Niyama, five, behavioral consequences. So you can't do this isomorphic thing. You can't just say, oh, because I had this, you're going to have this. Everything that happened now happened because of what happened in the previous life. It just doesn't work that way. Oh, and parenthetically, I almost forgot. I'm in conversation with Jim Tucker, who basically out of the University of Virginia, I'm going to be there in a couple of weeks at a conference. He's the guy who took over the mantle from Ian Stevenson, who did these amazing pioneering research studies at a UVA. Suggesting, thousands of studies, you read the literature, and it's incredibly powerfully suggestive of this whole rebirth, reincarnation phenomena. And Jim Tucker, MD, picked up the mantle and he's doing it now. So we're going to meet during the conference, and hopefully I'll be able to bring him in for an interview. But basically, here, Mary, this is really important. Everything arises because of causes and conditions. Karma arises because of causes and conditions. But that it does not follow, and that's the conflation, that everything therefore is karma. No, it's not. Because then you have this kind of determinism thing going on. And the world isn't that way. I mean, shit happens, accidents happen. It's not all karma. So this is where it's helpful to know about the four other orders, the different factors that influence causality, that influence phenomenal arising. And so therefore, this type of question is almost impossible to answer. The only person who could even attempt to answer that are really completely realized or very highly realized beings who can somehow tune into the tendril and say, this is what was due to a past situation. Now, with that said, I'm not saying that there aren't these kind of correlations. I'm not saying that. So I'm not swinging the pendulum all the way into the other positive baskets. I'm not saying that. In fact, part of Ian Stevenson's work and Jim Tucker's work is people come in and they'll have like a scar in this life or some little thing, and then they do a past life thing or whatever, and they find out that there was where a bullet went in. There's definitely something going on there, but you can't say that it's all due to karma. So in terms of like what's going on there, You have to ask really very, very, very few really highly realized beings have the capacity to tune into the tendril and say, this is due to that. And here's another thing. I understand where you're coming from here, and I get it. But let me just throw something out. This just came to my mind. That on one level, yes, knowing the history and the conditioning and all that kind of stuff, yes, provisionally, that's important. But on another level, don't get too hung up on that sort of thing. It, you know, the beautiful quote from James Joyce, history is a nightmare from which I'm trying to awake. And let me just share a story, a couple of stories around this that I think are important. One is from Dzigar Khyentse Rinpoche. I really like this guy. Wonderful Lama, semi-wrathful. I mean, his style is pretty cutting, and that's one of the reasons I really like him. And he was doing a presentation years and years and years ago up here in Boulder. There were a lot of Naropa students there and whatnot. And I'm paraphrasing. I'm sure, you know, I'm not doing what he said, the proper nuance and justice. But fundamentally, what he said after listening to two or three days of questions from all these students and whatnot, me paraphrasing him, he said, you know, you Westerners, you're always processing. He says, just cut. And this is, there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, I have never been, and again, I'm not criticizing the psychological thing. I'm not at all. I'm an integral student, has a place. That's why I interviewed Bruce Tift. I'm not criticizing any of this stuff. It all has a bandwidth here. But we just have to be really careful to put all our eggs in this one basket. I've never heard one spiritual teacher in the dozens and dozens and dozens that I've had interviews with to present with issues, not one said, tell me about your parents. Tell me about your past. Not one. Because they're more interested in the immediacy of the present moment. They're more interested in how are you going to relate to the phenomenal rising as it is now, right? That's, I think, really something to pay attention to. And once again, I'm not dismissing the validity of doing the psychograph, doing the history, doing the trauma stuff. I mean, when you do, if you do psychedelic assisted psychotherapy things and you're working with deep trauma, 99.9% of this is due to stuff that happened in your history. That stuff really has to be worked through. I'm not criticizing that. I'm just saying that we have to be a little careful. Precisely what I'm talked about with Bruce. We just haven't released that interview yet. The difference between the developmental and the fruitional approaches. The fruitional approach is more immediate. Presentational immediacy, Whitehead called it. What's happening right now? Work with that. The developmental approach deals more with the history, the psychology, the processing, the psychoanalysis, the psychotherapy. Yes, it has a place. But I think you get the point here. Don't get too caught up in you know, all this processing stuff. On one level, tadak, treksha, cut through. So part two of your question, does Buddhism have ideas about the circumstances of previous lives that lead to certain births, like breech, twins, face up? Yeah, of course they do. But they're, you know, not that much. You know, I mean, it's almost like tangential, really. And that's the way I relate to it. It's kind of interesting, but I'm not going to spend my time on it. Because first of all, well, anyway, I'll leave it. Could it be related to the type of death, violence, war? Yes, for sure. I have a friend who was born the same way who feels it meant she was kicking and screaming not to come back to samsara. That's an imputation in my estimation. I mean, who am I to say that that's accurate or not? But I would be a little cautious about this kind of imputation projection thing. In my world, that doesn't carry a lot of traction. That's just me. Do you have any experience with or comments on past life regression? I don't roll a whole lot in this world. Michael Newton's work. Yeah, Bob Thurman talks about him. I don't roll a ton with this. I did with this when I was a teenager. And again, I'm not criticizing this stuff, but when I was in the kind of new age thing, I'm not criticizing it. I did a little bit of that stuff. What was his name? William David, this wonderful guy. He was a past life regressive guy, an Akashic mediator. Akashic mediators, you know, like Casey was that, who could read the records, could read the Akasha, and then basically tell you, oh, this is what's happening, and, you know, what's happening in your life now is the working out of this particular karma. I think there's some absolute positivity, there's some validity to that. But I don't roll too much in these sorts of things. Past life regression stuff, I've never done it except for that one time. And I didn't do it intentionally. I wasn't hypnotized. I wasn't regressed. This is just what some guy, this guy said as an Akashic mediator. I don't roll too much in this world simply because I'm more fruitional in the sense of like what's happening, presentational immediacy, what's happening now. How can I relate to what's happening now? Because otherwise, like I mentioned, you can just get so caught up in all the factors. And a lot of this is really pretty conjecture. I mean, who's going to say with any authority on this stuff, right? So that's just me. That's just my disposition. So anyway, thanks, Mary. I hope that's helpful. Okay, from Joy. What a beautiful name. Your presentation a few weeks ago with a transitional life care was excellent. Thank you so much. I did a riff for them. They're a wonderful group. And inspired me to begin reading your books. Oh, that's very kind. Thank you for doing that. The books are beginning to arrive. Oh, that's exciting. Now I'm wondering if you recommend reading them in any particular order, which, oh, you're so very kind, which might be beneficial. I begun reading Preparing to Die. Thank you for your high energy presentation. Certainly as a, yeah. Thank you, Joy, for the kind words. You know, Joy, it kind of depends on what you're really interested in. That particular presentation was on end of life stuff. So I think beginning to read Preparing to Die would be the most appropriate in that instance. And then, what to say? You know, maybe my very first book, The Power and the Pain, because that's a little bit connected to transitions and whatnot. And then maybe Dream Yoga. But, you know, this is just like, there it is in Spanish. Beautiful. It's kind of like, what are you interested in? If you're interested in really, really deep, profound philosophy kind of theory, you're so kind bringing up these books. Look at that. Oh my gosh, that's so sweet. There's Joy bringing up all these books. She's got them all. You weren't kidding. Oh my God, Joy. You just made my whole day. There it is, because you know it's all about me. Oh, you're so sweet. Oh my God. You just made my whole day. Thank you so much. So, you know, if you're really into the deep, deep stuff, Dreams of Light is my deepest book. Meditation and the I Generation is probably the most accessible entry-level book. The Harbinger Press, our Lucid Dreaming Workbook is also probably one of the more easier books. And the other ones are slightly heavier lifting. And then I've got two more coming up. So maybe just roll with those, Joy. See what... you know, just inspires you when you look at the cover or whatnot. But I'm so touched that you would even ask the question or even buy my propaganda. Thank you so much, actually. It really means a lot to me. Thank you. Okay, from Patrick. In the 11 months since I joined Nightclub, that's those of you who may not be Nightclub members, that's the platform that we started almost 4 years ago to help people with nocturnal meditations. Since in the 11 months since I joined Nightclub, I've had 10 lucid dreams. That's very good. I know I would not have been able to accomplish this without the site. Well, that's really great. Thank you. Your help and the members. That's Patrick, that really makes me happy. Thank you. My lucid dreams are mostly short. That's fine. It doesn't mean that they're somehow less effectual or less profound. Short lucid dreams are fine. I become lucid and then wake up in about 30 seconds. That's super common. Can you recommend any tips on how to prolong the lucid dream and not wake up? Yes, I can. So number one is ask for more. Like if you're a fundraiser, you know, it's amazing what you can get if you just ask for it. And so by this, what I mean is we make a second order, a first order intentionality. I want to attain lucidity in my dreams. And this is actually quite comical when I do my dream yoga programs, because 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 days, depending on the person. Somebody who's never had a lucid dream will almost invariably have one. They come in the next day. It's actually quite touching. It's really sweet. They're just bursting. They just I just had my first lucid dream. It was just like, unbelievable. And then I'd probably say 80% of the time, they say exactly what you're saying, Patrick. But it didn't last very long. And so then I go, okay. Well, let's take a look at this. What did you ask for? Oh, I asked to have a lucid dream. You got what you asked for. Ask for more. Second order intentionality. I was listening to some teachings from Sugyen Rinpoche this week, where again, single instruction he gives for dream yoga / lucid dreaming is intention. And he was talking about, I hadn't heard this languaging from him before. I really like what he said, how it is that intentionality is that which bridges conscious and unconscious mind. I thought that was spot on. And so basically what you do here, Patrick, is second order intentionality. Put some octane in it. Yes, tonight I want to wake up. I want to have my lucid dreams. Number one order, you know, put another order in. I want to wake up in my dream and I want to have a longer dream so that I can do X, Y, and Z, right? So as seemingly simple as it is, patronizingly, set the intention, ask for more. And then the other thing you can do is, if you go back, Patrick, and listen to some of the earlier webinars that we did on Nightclub, I know I have at least one, if not two webinars devoted to exactly this topic, because it's so common. So if you go back through, we did like 50, 60 webinars. I can't remember how many we did. And I think it's pretty comprehensive and exhaustive with all these sorts of things. So I know I devoted at least one, if not two webinars to this topic. So if you want to go back in and listen to that, if you're a Nightclub member, that's a really good thing to do. But the next thing that is really, really helpful is with a little familiarity, you'll get a sense of when the dream is starting to dissipate. Well, actually, let me say there's two other things. So in addition to what I just said, when you have a lucid dream, you wake up in the dream, the first thing you want to do is remember, okay, wow, this is awesome. This is a lucid dream. Okay, what was I going to do today? This is why it's helpful to know and set an intention what you're going to do. That'll help you stay in the dream. So what was I going to do today? Oh, yes, today I was going to do whatever, fly, whatever, stage two, stage three, dream yoga, it doesn't matter. That will help you stay in it. And then immediately participate in something. Whatever's happening in the dream, get involved. Get involved in the dream. Because usually when you pop out of the dream, it's because you're in a certain sense, you're differentiating too far. You're backing out too far. And so lucidity is a tightrope. Not too tight, not too loose. If you're too loose, you're just going to flop right into a non-lucid dream. If you're too tight, you're going to pop out and wake up. So this is where it takes a little bit of practice. But what I've discovered is raise your gaze down. That keeps the winds down. So you're in a lucid dream, lower your gaze, because that actually, even though there's just your dream eyes in there, by lowering your gaze, you're lowering the winds, which are going to keep the winds from coming up into your head and they're going to keep them in the throat. Sometimes just look down at the ground, just literally look down, participate with whatever action is happening in the dream, engage it right away. And then one thing that you can do as the dream starts to fade, you'll start to notice this with some proficiency facility. You'll start to notice the colors become more black and white. The scenes become more disjointed, more fragmented. You'll start to know when the dream is starting to fall apart. When that happens, this is from Stephen LaBerge, and there's a physiological reason for doing this, and it bloody works. You start spinning like a whirling dervish. I can't tell you how many times I've done this. Literally, just like a whirling dervish, you start spinning. That engages the dream. It has something to do with the vestibular apparatus that helps kind of maintain the consciousness in the dreaming state. And if you don't want to do that, the other one that I discovered is just move your arms like pinwheels. Again, it's just this kind of this idea of participation, the participatory nature of the whole thing. So number one, intention, second order intention, ask for more. I want to have a lucid dream so I can do this. I want to have longer dreams, right? You wake up in the dream. What am I going to do? Remember? Oh yes, I'm going to do this. Engage the dream, look down. And then number three, when it starts to fall apart, start spinning. Okay, part of me thinks this is happening because I'm coming to the end of a REM cycle in the morning. Maybe. I can't say that unless you're actually hooked up and your sleep architecture can be registered. I can't tell you if that's the case. And awareness lucidity is entering the dream as it is coming to an end. My last two lucid dreams I have jumped while outside trying to fly. And I will catapult myself into the air real high and then come down landing, making a parabolic shape about a half mile from where I started. Well, that sounds kind of cool. Any tips on how to stay in the air longer? Yes, fit yourself with a parachute, man. Right? Put a parachute on your shoulder, dude. generate a parachute. I'm not kidding, right? Or a propeller. I'm being serious. Best yet, a propeller with a parachute. And then what? Intention again. Any tips on how to stay in the air longer? That is just adorable. I love that. And actually maneuver through the sky. Yeah. I mean, one is, again, setting the intention. And then I'm also not kidding. Put a little propeller. Just fit a propeller on your forehead. You know, you don't need a plane, right? This is kind of cool. Just create a propeller on your forehead, right? Right? Fit yourself with a parachute and then go for it. So somewhat playfully, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but also somewhat serious, right? And then get back to me, Patrick, let me know how that goes. That's really kind of cool. Okay, so let me see if I'm missing anything else, and then we can open it up to live questions. Let me see if there's one here. Oh yeah, from Matt, this came in earlier. Oh, I'd love to hear your thoughts on using lucid dreaming to overcome addictions. Specifically compulsive overeating. This is a good one. Well, I can say something a little bit more about the addiction part generically, the compulsive overeating thing. I mean, you have to have pretty stable, powerful lucid dreams to work with that kind of compulsivity. I'm not saying it's impossible in a dream. I think you can absolutely positively do it. But you got to be pretty stable. I've never tried working with that sort of thing. I mean, you could do, if you did try something, just thinking out loud, you could try some kind of role-playing thing. I have not read anything in the literature about this particular approach with compulsive overeating. Now, the notion of addiction, that's a different story. That I can say something about. And in fact, in the happiness program next week, I'm going to talk a little bit about, because I've been reading books like this. I will give you the title, Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. I'm super interested in the pathologies of online addiction, social media, toxicity, toxic spills online, that kind of stuff. And so I've always been very interested in the phenomenology of addiction. I wrote quite, I wouldn't say extensively, 2-3 chapters in my first book, Power and Pain, about the addiction principle, that fundamentally we're all addicts. We're all, Joy, if you look in the book, I think it's like part 2, somewhere in there, there's a couple of chapters on addiction, what I call ground addiction 1, ground addiction 2. I'm going to talk about this in the happiness program, because basically we're all addicts. Addiction is a matter of degree. We're all addicts. We live in the realm of addiction because this is literally the realm of samsara cosmologically. This is a realm of grasping, passion. This is a realm of addiction. And so what we know is conventional addictions are just epiphenomenal displays of this fundamental root addiction. We're all addicts. And I'll share on the weekend how I discovered this when the primary substance abuse that I was engaged in my 3-year retreat was taken away from me, stasis. And so this is where I discovered, I said, wow, we really truly are all addicts. I mean, this is not hyperbolic. This is literal. We're addicted. We're addicted to form. We're addicted to movement, which creates karma. We're addicted to substance. The principal substance abuse is thought. We abuse that substance. The other substance we abuse is matter, literally physicality. And so in the deeper part of the weekend, I'm going to talk about the whole addiction. Addiction is a term that originally came about related to paying off a debt that led to slavery. So I'll share some of the etymological and the first origin of the word addiction. So my thoughts on using lucid dreaming to overcome addictions, hard stop. Man, now that you can use big time. The specific thing about compulsive overeating, OCD, all these other kinds of things, I think that's completely viable. You have to have a pretty darn stable lucidity to do that kind of thing. But working to overcome addictions, that's part and parcel, not so much for lucid dreaming, but dream yoga, which transcends but includes lucid dreaming. And you could say, right, starting from ground zero, one of the principal addictions we're trying to overcome is our addiction to non-lucidity. Lucidity is a code word for awareness. Non-lucid dreams are distracted dreams. We are distraction junkies. We are addicted to distraction. That's why this is such a dark age. And so lucid dreaming, dream yoga to overcome addictions, I mean, that's what dream yoga is all about. Addiction to all these bad habit patterns. I mean, habit patterns come into play here. Basically, habit formation is a tautology. We're addicted to these things, karma. And so lucid dreaming, dream yoga for overcoming that, absolutely, positively. And so if you go to these kind of root addictions, ground addictions, as I call them, the principal ground addictions are addiction to movement, our addiction to form, to body, to thought, that kind of substance abuse. This takes place all the time. You go after those ground addictions, all this other stuff is going to fall away because it's just a deck of, you know, house of cards. And the compulsive overeating and all these other secondary, tertiary, quaternary addictions, they're all epiphenomenal to these root addictions. And so that, Matt, this stuff is totally addressed somewhat a little bit in lucid dreaming, massively in dream yoga. I mean, dream yoga is largely about just this. So I'm not sure if you're here, Matt, and you want to come on, I can definitely riff a ton more on that. But that's what comes to mind for now. Okay. And I think that's all I have. If there's any live questions or comments, if someone is here that I did address your question and you want to follow up or some points of clarification, you want me to say more, just raise your hand and come on. In the meantime, I will look in the chat column and see what pops up here.
All right, we've got Jerry with his hand up.
Dr. J. Oh, yeah, out of silence. Yes, on the mechanics of happiness. Yes, it wasn't published. It was a 400-page training book that I wrote in 1996 that I'm literally, I told you when I'm doing the book stuff, book club sharing thing, that I generally don't read my books. I haven't read this book in 30 years. And so it's actually kind of fun. And I don't know if I'll pitch this to a publisher. I might self-publish it. If my house doesn't burn down, I don't have this. I wrote this on an Apple, Mac Applewood has screen about this big, right? With a floppy. And so I don't even have that. So I have one hard copy in a 3-ring binder, 400 pages. So if my house doesn't burn down and that's gone, I might try to self-publish it later. But yeah, that one I didn't publish yet. Okay, let me just get a couple more here from Candy and then I'll get Dr. J. Where did you address end of life stuff? Yeah, so Candy, I did this. I did a presentation. You can find it on their site, TLC, Transitional Life Care. They invited me to do a riff. So I presented something there. Check out their website. This is, they really have some wonderful people. A lot of Lamas, Rinpoches and whatnot have come on. And I was quite flattered when they invited me. So I did a fun rant, a riff with them a couple of weeks ago, Transitional Life Center. You can find it there. I'm about to take a death doula training and would love to know what other organizations are out there that I'd be missing. Well, you know, since you brought it up, I wasn't going to say anything because we're going to start pitching this in 2 weeks after the happiness program is over. But if you go on my main site, Candy, you'll see a link. We just posted it like a week ago. This is a program, no exaggeration. We've been working on it for 10 years. A 3-month, really rigorous, comprehensive, spiritual, practical preparation for the end of life, benefiting self and other. I haven't started kind of promoting that just because there's other things that are in line. But the actual program won't start until July 5th. But it's a really, we're super excited about it. So if you go on the main site, my main site, we just put the link up there. It'll give you a really pretty systematic overview of what we're presenting there. I'm really excited about it. So much more on that later. Okay, hold on, Dr. J, one from Tim and then to you. I am still very interested in your 3-year retreat and have some questions. What were your main gains from that? Oh my gosh, Tim. This was the most transformative thing I ever did in my life. I wrote a paper on it. I think it's on my main site. It's called Rocks into Rubies. I wrote, it's the first thing I ever wrote coming out of the retreat. This three-year retreat was the most transformative thing I ever did in my life. I don't even know where to begin to tell you what were my main gains. One was I discovered that I'm an addict. I mean, that was a really powerful thing. The first 3 months were unbelievably difficult, and I really wasn't doing anything, really. And it's like, why is this so bloody hard? So I realized I was in a detox center, and I was detoxing from samsara. I was detoxing from Western, I'm still in recovery from Western civilization. So, I don't even know where to, really, this was the most impactful thing I've ever done in my life. The whole nocturnal meditation thing completely came alive for me. I did 50, 60 different practices over 3 years. Everything I've riffed on since has been germinated from what happened in the three-year retreat. Power and Pain was inspired by that book. All the Bhakti yoga stuff I do, all the dreaming stuff started in retreat, all the nature mind stuff I'm doing now. There's no way I can overstate the impact of this time. I mean, 3 years of constant, complete, actually it was 5 years. It was 1 year in, 1 year out, 1 year in, 1 year out. It was a 5-year retreat. I don't even know where to stop. There's just so much here. I know that your development of lucid dreaming was a very main and important one, but what about some of the others? Well, Bardo Yoga came into play, Mahamudra, the Yinam deities. I mean, you name it, man. I mean, this is a whole book right here. Did they remain after the retreat or did they fade away? Well, that's the difference between Nyam and Tokpa, states and traits. Some of the states weren't stable, but that's why you come out and you stabilize them. So some faded, others, the ones that I had a sweet spot for, stayed with me and have turned somewhat stable. Did you stay there the whole 3 years? No, 1 year in, 1 year out. I had a chance to mix meditation with post-meditation to incorporate the first year's training and to prepare for the second year's training. So it was really a 5-year retreat. Did you basically live like a monk? Yes, I did. Shaved head, robes, and everything. I loved it. Do you think this could be done and still maintain a marriage? It's possible, but it ended mine. I lost everything. I died. I lost my job. I lost my house. I lost my wife. I lost everything. It was a death. Can you do it and maintain a marriage? Yes. Is it easy? No. Somebody's got to have a really together kind of unit there. It can be done. I know people who've done it. It's just not easy. I have more, but that's enough for now. Yes, I have more, but I also think that's enough for now. You get me started on my 3-year retreat. We're going to be here for 3 years. This is by far the most impactful, transformative thing I have ever, ever done. And for people who are interested in like long retreat things, I can't overstate the importance, the preciousness of working with your mind and your heart without distraction for so long, so intensively. It's a complete, it'll change, it'll turn your life upside down. It changes everything. So yeah, I'll stop there because otherwise we'll be here forever. By far the best thing I've ever done in my life, hands down. Okay, Dr. J and then Mary. Fire away, Dr. J.
Oh, hello, Andrew. This Monday I was listening to Jeffrey Stephens.
Oh, he's such a great guy. I love him.
As usual, it was a marvelous program. Marvelous. Immediately after the program ended, my web browser, I went to the New York Times, the front page. And what I saw there was something mind-boggling. Usually if you click on an article, if you don't have a subscription, something pops up and it covers up the article.
Right. Yeah, I know. Totally.
Well, anyways, this time, when I went to the New York Times, right at the top of the page on the right-hand side, there was an article there. It was an interview of Dr. Roland Griffiths.
I know, Roland Griffiths, yeah, who's dying, and he's a psychedelic guy. Yeah, I'm going to see him this summer when he comes to the MAPS conference.
Amazing is if you clicked on it, it actually showed the article, if you had a subscription or not. And, he's the head of Center for Psychedelics and Consciousness
Research. John Hopkins.
In the interview, he says, that he has stage 4 incurable colon cancer.
Yeah, he's dying. Yeah.
He died?
No, he's dying.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that's exactly what he said. And it was amazing what he said, like how his life was full of happiness and joy. And
he's a beautiful human being. I mean, check out the movie Aware. Is that what it's called? Listen, maybe you can help me. Aware, something in consciousness. This is a really beautiful, beautiful film. I show it in my Bardo programs. And there's a really extensive little riff, a clip there with Roland Griffiths. He's one of the premier voices from Johns Hopkins, actually in the world now, in psychedelic, especially psilocybin. He's a colossus, and he's a beautiful human being. You'll also hear a number of really beautiful, I don't know who the podcasts are off the top of my head, I'd have to dig them up, but he's done some really powerful, extensive podcasts around what he's facing now. And I mean, yeah, I mean, I kind of cut you off a little bit, Dr. J, but he's a wonderful, wonderful man.
Yeah. Hey, you've met him personally?
No, I'm going to meet him this summer. I haven't met him personally, no. I've never been to Johns Hopkins, but I definitely know his work. He's a giant in the world of psychedelic research, colossus.
Yeah, because he says in the interview, his doctors give him a 50-50 chance of living until Halloween.
Yeah, right.
But yeah. I mean, it's a fantastic article.
My friend David Lloyd sent it to me. He's an amazing human being. So if you can get it, I highly recommend you read it completely.
Oh, I did. I
mean, everybody here who's watching.
Yeah. Okay. Really,
thanks, Dr. J.
Thanks. Cool. Thanks,
Andrew. Mary, how are you?
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. So I listened to your interview today with Dr. Is it Fagin?
Federico Fagin.
Fagin.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. I learned so much from you. Towards the end of the interview, you said, I just want to get it right, that for many years you have drunk the Tibetan Buddhist Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
Mostly for tax purposes. And I wondered if you could expand on that and explain it as somebody who's taken your two Pure Land retreats and many other Buddhist courses with you. I was perplexed.
Oh, it's interesting that that's what you would focus on. That's very playful. Yeah, you know, so yeah, you know, it's just my goofy humor with, I really got into a playful place with Federico. You know, I mean, this guy's like some freaking genius, right? I mean, founder of the microprocessor, founder of the touchpad, founder of all these amazing companies. I mean, rich beyond means. He's amazing. And his book, Silicon, is really interesting. And he has an incredibly sophisticated quantum information-based panpsychism view on consciousness that is not at all easy to understand. So anyway, that's the sidebar. So I basically said that somewhat playfully, you know, I've drunk the Tibetan Buddhist Kool-Aid. I mean, that's the Kool-Aid I was drinking for 5 years in a retreat. I love the flavor. But I also acknowledge that, you know, you guys know, if you know me at all, I'm a integral person. I'm a curious, you know, the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist, for God's sake. Christ wasn't a Christian, right? And so when I say I'm a Buddhist for tax purposes, I say that somewhat playfully. That I have, and again, I have tremendous. I mean, my shrine is over here. I've got shelves and shelves. Everything you're seeing here. These are my practice texts. These are all my liturgies. I mean, I have probably 1,000 books on Tibetan Buddhism, and so it's still. This is like still my main gig, right? I am a deep, concerted student of Tibetan Buddhism, but nobody has a patent on truth. And listen, we haven't posted it yet, but when in my riff with Bruce Tiff coming up, we talk about how there's no discipline anywhere on the planet that's complete in its description of reality. If they say they are, BS. Listen to my conversation with Sean Esbjorn Hargens. Listen to any integral theorist. So, I mean, I have tremendous allegiance to Tibetan Buddhism. It's my gig. When I die, I'm going to visualize the deities. I'm going to do my Poa practices. I'm going to do everything I've been trained. But I'm also, you know, I'm a deep fan of truth. The Buddha, wherever you find the truth, you will find my Dharma. I don't care where it comes from. I'll take it from the physicists. I'll take it from the philosophers, from the neuroscientists. And so therefore that was just a little bit of a playful thing of don't limit yourself. Don't ossify your tradition. Don't circle the wagons around your own thing. Because if you do that, I had this thing on every one of my emails, this beautiful quote from Thich Nhat Hanh, that the minute you start to think you know everything, that's the end of your progress. The minute you think you have one whatever that's going to solve it, you, right off the rest of your evolution, that's just ego coming into play. And so the Buddhists are completely aware of this, self-liberate, even the antidote, the emptiness of emptiness thing. They have this really very powerful self-corrective mechanism that if you really pay attention to the Buddhist teachings altogether, they're just a raft to get you to the other shore. And then you run around with a raft on your back, you leave it on the shore, you let it all behind. Self-liberate, even the antidote. So I don't know where else to run with this, Mary, but basically I abide very powerfully by the tenets. I think it's, for me, it's the most powerful descriptive mechanism, plus all the skillful means for exploring mind and reality. And that's why I do consider myself a card-carrying Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist. But
I asked because I didn't pick up the humor at all. So I'm really happy I asked you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was probably just went too fast. No, yeah. it's all said tongue-in-cheek, right? So hopefully that helps.
Yes, okay? Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Hey, Gillian. Did
Hi.
I pronounce your name right?
It's Gillian, but you'd be right.
Gillian with the hard.
You'd be right 90% of the time, so keep with it. But thank you. I want to ask a question, and I'm going to apologize to all of you because I was part of the nightclub, and then I'm working a lot, so it's sort of one of those. I'm seeing clients by night and teaching by day, so it's too much. But so I'm asking a novice question about dreams, okay. And what it is, and it's a little graspy. And with meditation, I'm not graspy. Like I've sort of, and I've loved your books. By the way, The Power and the Pain was really helpful to me in a time I really needed it, and it was like a little those floats in a lake. The dock in the lake, in the middle of the lake. So thank you. I've used your dreams of light in a little, small, short retreat, but I've got it from, you were in Joe's group the other night. And so I've pulled it out because I want to start reading Dreams of Light again and delving into it and thinking about it, during my work day. But with the dreams, let me give you a little quick thing about, I'm going to own that I'm a little graspy. I think I'm a little graspy. And part of it is I'm so busy and I wish the dreams were more, there's karma of this life dreams where I'm dreaming about my parents aging and they're very sweet. And so I know I'm just kind of that kind of anticipatory grief. Fine. I'm bewilderingly dreaming of sort of teenage. I mean, really high school. Like, I didn't even like high school. I sort of got out and I never went to a reunion, but I'm having dreams of people I knew then. Then another level, a little more interesting, is just that more metaphoric recurring dreams of cleaning dirty toilets in abandoned houses. That's my wonderful recurring dream. Everyone now knows my dirty laundry. Thank you, everyone here. But, we have that. We have that kind of dream. Then I have dreams where, Chökyi Nyima Rinpoche comes and tell me things, or Sidney Rinpoche will tell me things. And I don't, with great respect, I mean, I believe in blessings and these are teachers of mine, but I do think that's still me in these particular instances.
Probably.
One Dilgo Khyentse came and gave me an actual breath practice that was like shocking. And so who knows, I don't know, but the only one I know, and I'm not grasping for this, it's just miraculous, was I was here and a person very close to me was in Nepal and took, my name was given to Chöchö Rinpoche. I was woken by a phone call saying, and I was dreaming of Chöchö Rinpoche and he was doing purification on me. And as the phone rang, the person is saying, I'm going to the Shedra, but I gave your name to Chöchö Rinpoche. So that I say only to say how beautiful that we are in this ocean, an ocean together, that a master could come and do that.
That's really cool.
So because of that, I have to admit, my dreams are usually just cluttered, clogged. And that's the heart of my question is my dreams are usually cluttered, clogged, karma of this life dreams. I have not lucid dreamt because I haven't tried. I need to make time in my life, I will be quiet and ask if you have any thoughts on the unclogging the karmic cluttered dreams,
Yeah, I mean, really great stuff. Thank you for being so so open and honest and candid. It's great. I mean, you know, here's a wonderful thing about the whole dream arena. There's so many ways to engage that particular display of the mind, right? And dreams, just like there are so many different states of mind during the day, our dreams vary across a tremendous spectrum from kind of low level neurological noise that really utterly meaningless, just discharge of whatever. Now, that doesn't mean you can't use those dreams to initiate lucidity and then practice lucid dreaming and dream yoga. That's the cool thing. Whatever dream it is, it doesn't matter. You can go lucid in the dream, even if it is neurological noise, and then you can transform that into something to do on the path. So that's really cool. So if you're staying just within the bandwidth of the applicability and spectrum of dreams altogether, they range from mere just completely ignore neurological noise in terms of like interpretation and whatnot. It's just meaningless. All the way up to these hyperlucid theophantic dreams, where these are life-changing dreams, the big dreams, dreams of clear light, dreams of clarity. I mean, I've been blessed to have a number of these. These are among the most precious, impactful dreams I've ever had. And not even say dreams, experiences. Most of them are lucid, but not all. I mean, some of these most incredibly powerful dreams are non-lucid dreams, but they came with such tremendous impact that it was like, wow, this is huge. So one thing is to become familiar with the spectrum of dreams, the spectrum of mind and how it generates these dreams. And I believe in my book, again, Shameless Self-Promotion, the Dream Yoga book, I talk about the taxonomy of dreams. I talk a little bit more specifically about all the different ways that these dreams actually arise. And again, this is such a massive topic, but one thing that is definitely worth saying when you talk about these experiences with Chacho Rinpoche or Chikinima or whatever entering your dream, could they, you know, are they just, they're called dreams of clarity dreams. These are just basically dreams that are good karmic dreams. They're still within samsara, but it's just the penthouse of samsara, where you're just having really great dreams of these teachers. But when you have something like what you mentioned with Chacho Rinpoche, let me just share a story with you. This was shared to me not too terribly long ago with a person who I've known for decades. And who was very, very, very close to Trungpa Rinpoche, by the way, whose party Nirvana was just a few days ago. And she shared this amazing story with me. She said she was in an intimate situation with him, and she was sharing a dream about him. And Rinpoche turned and looked at her very directly in the face and said, "Well, you know, that was me." Mm-hmm. And she went, "Oh, yeah, right, thanks." No, he got more serious, more direct. "That was me." And then, you know, yeah, thanks, Rinpoche. Really nice thing to say. Yeah. Third time, almost wrathful. "That was me." In other words, he did enter her mind stream. And so therefore, these types of clear light dreams where the parameters of the statute of limitations and all the things that create boundaries in samsara, they dissolve in the dream arena. That's why the laws of physics don't apply. And as you become more porous, I used to think, being more conservative and scientist kind of guy, I used to think that all dreams were solipsistic. They were all just part of your mind. They're not. Mm-hmm. Especially when you become more porous to yourself and you open, your mind stream can definitely be infiltrated by these agencies. And so Chacho Rinpoche can absolutely positively enter your mind stream. It's not an archetype. It's him.
Yeah.
I'm more and more convinced of that. Before I was like, I'm not so sure about this. This doesn't fit into the neuroscience thing. But I really trust these people, and I've had these experiences myself. I've been so blessed. And sometimes I just know. I said, "Man, that was not me." So you know, in terms of like the interpretation thing, again, you're throwing so many noodles against the wall. The interpretation is super powerful. It's not part of dream yoga. Dream yoga doesn't care about dream content at all. It's like the difference between meditation and therapy. When you're engaged in meditation, you don't care about the contents of your mind. You care about how you relate to those contents. It's therapeutic, but it's not therapy, right? So if you want to engage in therapy, completely valid. I'm not dissing it at all. That's fine. Then you start processing, working with the content and that kind of thing. Meditation doesn't care about that, period. Psychology does, meditation doesn't. Same thing with dream yoga. Dream yoga doesn't give a whit about dream content. Yes, there can be parenthetical benefits, collateral benefits with this type of porosity. I've discovered this a lot. The more I do this, I just have more and more of these really amazing dreams. But dream yoga is not interested in dream content. It's interested in how you relate to that content, how you transform it, what you do with it. Now, with that said, the dream interpretation thing, analysis thing, is tremendously important. And in particular, my favorite is Jungian depth psychology, working with dreams in that capacity. Absolutely brilliant. And I know people who are really sophisticated Jungians and others, Adlerians and others, that work with dream interpretation. Spot on, do it. But again, dream yoga transcends what includes that. So understand that that's just a particular bandwidth. Yes, you can process stuff. Yes, you can release stuff. Yes, all the stuff, starting with Freud and his monumental interpretation of dreams all the way up to the most recent thing. I mean, Moss's many books on this. 100% valid. I'm not dissing that at all. But in the integral spectrum approach to things that has a particular bandwidth that dream yoga is just not that interested in. So the graspy quality, say more a little bit more about that before I let you go with this. What do you mean by the graspy quality? That you want something out of it, or you're just give me a little bit more about what you mean by that.
Yeah, I think it's the most power. I mean, other than, you know, being in Parping and, you know, with the Lama telling you something, you know, in the way, you know, the dreams are the most powerful teacher. I mean, in some, you know, I mean, in my life, like when I have, beautiful. I'm kind of like, you know, but it's just, it's haunting. And it's, I'm a focuser, Genlin focuser for like 23 years. So it's like,
is it Genlin?
Yeah, I'm a focuser. I didn't know Genlin, no, but I mean, I'm a Genlin focuser, you know, like,
oh, I see. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it's like, and I work like Leslie Ellis is, you know, is a dream person that does focusing with dreams, but I mean, that's sort of focusing is another powerful space for me, but dreams, it's like, I think why I shared, and I was willing to say some of this stuff here with people is that
we're all friends
in bringing up the chatter, you know, the fact that that's possible, the fact that, like I said, I think sometimes it is me, you know, and Chokinim is there, but like the Dilgo Khyentse one, I'm too young to have met him, but it's very odd. I mean, it's so powerful. He gave me a breath practice. I don't want to talk about it here, but it was so powerful. It was like a moment of death practice. And that's and it. Yet my mind, it's so cluttered. There's Devin from high school on the skateboard. I mean, I'm just,
right.
I know I'm processing my parents. That I don't mind, but some
yeah,
of
them. So let Devin skateboard away. Don't pay attention to Devin. Let him
go on. Yeah, you know?
Yeah, and then invite Dingo Kinsir and Pichai Yen, right? And then just really pay homage to that and feed that. And, you know, I mean, here's the other thing you said, it's odd.
I'm interrupting you, but I'm preferring. That's what I'm saying about grasping is I am preferring, you know, in meditation, it's sort of, I've learned, but I'm being graspy in the sense of, please send me more dreams.
That's not graspy. There's a difference between that and aspiration, you know? So centrifuge out the graspy thing and cultivate the aspiration thing. And in terms of the odd thing, I mean, Jeffrey Kripal, I really love this guy, Jeffrey Kripal, Rice University religious scholar. I really like his thinking. He once said something that's just spot on. The weirder it is, the truer it is. So when you have something really odd, really just whatever weird, I mean, these are intimations of the non-dual. So who says it's odd? Aristotle, the Western world, conventional science. To me, these kind of anomalous experiences, they're intimations of reality. And so therefore, when you start to become more, like, this is also completely connected to dreams because dreams are generally really odd, right? That's why dreams are more in contact with reality. So if something's really weird, high five, that means you're actually more approximating truth. You're opening yourself up to these really bizarre things and only bizarre because they don't fit into your view of reality or whatever your Western culture says your view should be. So listen, if you haven't listened to the two podcasts I did with Sean, S. Bjorn Hargens, listen to that. I mean, this guy's freaking brilliant on this stuff. So basically, I understand the graspy thing. Maybe just replace that with more aspirations.
Yeah.
Just treasure, open these lines of communication, treasure your super conscious, unconscious mind. And the more you do that, the more you become a ready conversationalist. It's like the universe responds and the world, your dream world will just explode. That doesn't mean it's all lucid dreams. Those are fine. They're great. But it just means your whole dream arena will just flower. More dreams, clearer dreams, stronger dreams, weirder dreams. I mean, all kinds of wonderful, magical things that take place when the mind starts to basically get crowbarred out of this exclusive identification with reified external form. So, okay.
Thank you, really.
Cool. Welcome. Yeah, great questions. I appreciate it. Okay, maybe two more from Matt and then Shariputra. AKA Pramdas. Hey, Matt.
Hi there, Andrew. I have a question, but I wanted to make a brief request first.
Okay.
And by the way, your audio is breaking up a little bit for me. Hopefully mine isn't for you.
Mine is.
But it's probably my computer. But,
yeah,
but
I think so, because my modem router is right here. So it's usually not coming from me. Anyway.
Yeah. So I did your Pure Land retreat, the first one, and I thought it was great. I'm really, really helpful. I purchased it online. I wanted to purchase the second one, but apparently that isn't available. So I wanted to purchase. So I wanted to ask first if that might change, and also Alyssa suggested that you might be doing another one of the Pure Land 2 retreats sometime in the future.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe. Definitely not this year. My cup overflowed.
Oh, really?
But let me check with my peeps, Matt, about the second Pure Land program and where that is in terms of like availability. I literally just don't know. So let me check in with that. And then Alyssa, this is your job.
I know the answer, actually.
You know the answer?
I do. So
ask online, but okay.
Wait, she has an answer. Let her speak.
Yeah, we were just going to not have it available for purchase because we were going to do one in the future. So we were just hanging on to the recording for now.
Because we were going to do one in the future? Is that what you said? No.
Yep, that was the plan.
I guess I'm going to do it in the future. You know, Matt, ping me via my Andrew at andrewholacek.com email address. That'll go to Alyssa. She'll forward it to me. And then I can tell you a little bit more about what is going on around all that. I'm sure Alyssa's right. I have so much stuff going on right now. I just don't really know. But thank you for your interest and ping me at that address, and then I can let you know behind.
I will.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I'm highly interested. I thought it was really so interesting.
I appreciate you saying that. I can tell you one thing. Here's one thing I can tell you, and this has not been announced to anybody yet. Alyssa doesn't even know this. I have my fourth Bardo week coming up this August at Jala Mountain Center. The fifth program, which I've never done before, is going to be a week long Sutra Tantra Pure Land. So it's basically going to be both those weekends plus a whole lot more packed into a 7-day program. So that's coming up next August. That's going to be the fifth week in the 5-year program. So nobody knows about that. You're the first to know. So that's another possible opportunity. Okay.
Okay. That sounds great. So my question is maybe a simple question. This is about the relationship between sleep yoga and the after-death bardos. So I believe I heard you say at some point somewhere that you were talking about how difficult it is to, you know, to recognize the clear light of the ground luminosity at the time of death. And you said how difficult it is to be aware in deep sleep.
Seems to be that
so way. I guess my question, yeah. So my question is whether that's an analogy or actually a kind of criterion. So in other words, if you can't be aware in deep sleep, then you know that's a good indicator you're not going to be able to recognize the clear light.
Depends on who you talk to. Depends on who you ask. Because if you ask some people, they will say it's completely indicative. It's a pop quiz for the final exam. I mean, I'll just tell you what I've heard. If you don't have consistency and lucidity in the lucid dream state, you're not going to have a lucid bardo becoming. If you don't have consistency in lucid sleep, you're not going to have a lucid dharma ta experience. That really, you know, Kabir, what is found now is found then. That makes sense. Other teachers will tell you that just because plan A isn't working, it doesn't mean plan B or plan C may not kick into gear. So this one depends on who you ask. It depends. And I actually like, I mean, this is just the way I roll with this. I understand the basic correlations around the more kind of hardcore. You don't see this now, you're not going to see it then.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, here's one thing. Yeah. Even if you have a glimpse, here's the kicker. This is the really good news. When you're in the Bardos, everything is exaggerated, the good, the bad, and the ugly, 7 to 9 times. And that's an archetypal number. It means more than that. So you can therefore have a very bare recognition of the child luminosity, the clear light. And then that can grow up. That can basically lead all the way to the 10th Bhumi. So I personally, the way I roll, even though I see the logic behind the little bit, the limit kind of thing, to me, it seems to make a little bit more sense, just me, that it's not quite that ironclad cold. But again, I've asked a lot of teachers this. It really kind of depends on who you ask. I'm a little bit more, come to my class. You know, it's easier to pass my exam, my final exam, easier than most. I think you're if you have a glimpse of the nature of mind, it doesn't take much for that glimpse to flash into a full-blown gaze at the moment of death. You know, if the child recognizes the mother, and that's enlightenment in one life, that makes, I don't know, that makes a lot of sense to me. Plus, it gives me a little bit more hope, you know, because it's like, I'm screwed. You know, you're totally screwed if you don't have this level of recognition. That starts to sound pretty, I'll say this with all the love I can, kind of Christian to me, right? You know, if you don't believe in whatever, you're screwed. I don't know. That doesn't roll very well with me. That's just me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I appreciate you saying that. That's sort of exactly my feeling about it. Because I don't have a lot of lucidity in dreams, let alone in deep sleep. So it just makes it seem as if, doing all this other work and, you know, working in nature of mind is, at least at that point, it's not going to be at all helpful unless I have this one particular skill, which at least right now I don't.
Doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't make sense to me, right? I think nature and reality is a little bit more forgiving than that. I'm naive and blindly hopeful, but no, I don't think so. I mean, anyway, that's the way I roll. Okay, bud?
Yeah, okay. Great, thank you so much. That's really helpful.
Okay, Shariputra. And then somebody else was there, but they disappeared.
Yes, sir.
I like the sir part.
You mentioned a little earlier about some of the more profound dreams, clear light dreams that you've had, but then maybe I misunderstood. Then you said some of them you have not been lucid.
Correct.
So does that mean that you just had a vivid memory of them?
No, them being what? A clear light dream?
Profound dreams.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, you just wake up from them, even though the dream wasn't lucid. You wake up from them and you're going, holy mofo, that was one massive dream. And I've had a number of those that weren't lucid. I wasn't aware when I was in the dream that I was dreaming. But I wake up from them and I'm just shaken. I mean, in a really great way. It's like, wow, this is amazing. I mean, I don't know what else to say on that.
So does that imply that if one has an accurate memory of the dream, is that sort of a on the path to lucidity? Is that sort of an interim state? I mean, that's worth something? Yes.
Absolutely, positively. Right. Okay. I mean, you know, even Stephen LaBerge says, right, he softened this, but he used to say that if you can't remember at least 2 dreams a night, don't even bother with lucid dreaming. And so one of the characteristics of progress is people say they don't dream. Everybody dreams, unless they have extremely rare brain organic dysfunctions. Everybody dreams. They just don't remember. So you start working with this, and then you start to have flickers of recollection with dreams. You start to remember more dreams. They become clearer. They last longer. They become, you know, micro lucid dreamless. Then there's a kind of a natural progression. But again, it's not particularly linear. It's like a tide coming in, right? Comes in, comes back, comes in, comes back, comes in, comes back. But generally, you know, your relationship to your dream mind, your dream experience would absolutely positively just continue to unfold. Now, does that mean constant lucidity all the time? Not necessarily. It could mean just a heightened everything I just talked about, right? And that's one of the really cool things about dream yoga and all the other nocturnal meditations like liminal dreaming. You know, it's just so much more than the specific limited bandwidth of lucid dreaming. And that's why I roll with all these other, four other liminal nocturnal meditations. It's all about the entire arena of relating to the nocturnal mind. That's the whole dream yoga, sleep yoga rubric. And along that, then there's all these other massive collateral benefits. It's not all about just 100% success metric of lucidity. No. Not my experience doing this for 40 years.
So in summary, if one is able to accurately and vividly remember a dream, that has some value on the path.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Now that doesn't necessarily mean that particular dream carried a particular
moment. The content, right. Once again. Right.
But the ability to recollect, well, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
Very helpful. Very helpful.
The other question I had, you mentioned that you drank the Buddhist Kool-Aid, but no system or whatever has the ultimate claim on understanding reality completely. Then how would you respond to someone who has sort of mastered the nature of mind experience, whether it's a Dilgo Khyentse or a Milarepa or whatever? Do they not have a claim on our understanding of ultimate reality fully?
Well, no, that's not at all what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that's a particular, even if you have that, right? It doesn't mean you become omniscient in all these other domains. You know,
Of course not. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You can't become a master chess player if or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So that last question is not entirely clear to me. I mean, what are you just saying more?
What you said, maybe I misunderstood, but it implied that there's nobody in any tradition that has a clear understanding of the absolute truth.
Oh, no, I didn't say that. I definitely did not say that.
Okay, so I misunderstood.
Yeah, first of all, who am I to say that, for God's sake? I would never say that. I mean, how do we know? I mean, here's what, you know, to me, it's just like, this is an ongoing dance, right? I mean, here's one of the things about enlightenment and kind of absolutism and this kind of reified finality. That doesn't work for me. I hardly even use the word enlightenment anymore. You know, this is an endless ongoing play. It just continues to unfold. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't some access to the changeless nature, understanding the display from this kind of wonderful, fantastic, so-called enlightened space. But forms will forever evolve. I mean,
definitely. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Am I saying that? Anyway, I think we got it. I think we're good.
Right. My last question very quickly. You've said Rupert Spira
has
an absolutist perspective.
You know, I'm going to be very cautious. I am extremely hesitant to talk about other people unless I can talk about them in completely complimentary.
Not that he's good or bad, but what do you mean by absolutist, right? That's kind of what I meant.
Well, yeah. So let's just take Advaita Vedanta. And again, I've had these conversations with Swami Sarvapriyananda and other people. Mm-hmm. There's you know, the whole non-dual thing, the absolute truth thing. Hey, man, I mean, how can you criticize that? Well, I think the only way you can criticize it is if you become absolutistic and you don't acknowledge things like developmental structures. You don't develop, you don't recognize some of the play of karma, some of the play of evolution. You know, you really, it's called quadrant absolutism in integral theory. You become it's kind of a spiritual bypass where everything's kind of thrown in the emptiness basket in Buddhist language. And that to me is a colossal mistake. And it doesn't acknowledge the multifarious display of the relative reality. And so this is where things get really tricky, because people think, got to get out of this complex, messy, materialistic thing and get into the absolute spiritual thing. Well, yes, I guess on one level that's true. But then what happens to all the messy, materialistic, physical things, right? So I just get a little uncomfortable with some of the absolute non-dual approaches, because I think they can very easily fall. And again, I'm not saying this about Rupert. Be very clear about this. I think Rupert's amazing. But everybody, and this is what I talk about with Bruce, everybody by nature, by definition, everybody is limited, man. I mean, sorry. Everybody is limited. And to think that you're not, that's a major limitation right there, right? Everybody has colossal blind spots, in my opinion. Maybe it's just me. Everybody has their shtick. I mean, whatever. And so the absolute thing, I get a little bit tweaked about some of that, because it's very easy to just do it the Nike approach, just, you know, put all your eggs in the absolute emptiness basket. No, don't do that, because then you've just swung the pendulum all the way into spiritualism. And then that's just, I mean, I think that's really, really highly limiting. That's kind of the Dharmakaya trap. Then what do you do with the Rupakayas? I mean, the fundamental fruition is not the Dharmakaya, even though it seems to be like, oh, we got to go to the Dharmakaya, pointing out the Dharmakaya, everything's a Dharmakaya. No, it's not. The Dharmakaya is just one third of it, so to speak. What do you do with the Rupakayas? What do you do with some Nirmanakaya, some Bhogakaya? To me, it's all about integration, working with all these different plays. So that's just the way I roll. I just get a little tweaked personally, because I know a lot of people, me included, and I say this because I slipped into these traps, think that you can just slide into the absolute camp and it's just going to take care of everything. I don't think so. That's just me. I don't think so.
Well, thank you for clarifying. And again, the tradition emphasizes the integration of the three kayas with the Svabhavika kaya, right?
Absolutely. The Hindus do it too. Turiya, Turiya, Tita. Right. Yeah, the integration is key. Because otherwise, yeah, it's so easy to just slide off into these, you know, versions of spiritual escapism fundamentally. I think that's highly problematic.
Super. Thank
you, Shariputra. Okay, Luke, one more, and then I'm going to pick up one or two in the chat column and we'll call it for today. Fire away, bud.
Thank you, Andrew. A pleasure to be here. Actually, one thing I wanted to share at the beginning was in terms of the weird space of phenomena of reality, very recently, having done a private a personal retreat, I was doing a Vajrayana retreat. I was by myself for 3 days. And in the midst of a lot of flotsam jetsam dreaming, I had what appeared like what I'd call an intergalactic sadhu in Ashen. And I have no idea why. And it was like the experience of like, we interrupt this program to bring you, and this person, this head, this being showing up. And I was just like, what is going on? Who are you? And I immediately auto-ejected out of that reality because I just was a little bit surprised. But, you know, to Gillian's point and to what the conversation you were having, it was, to me, it was very rich in the sense that I was like, okay, this was a being. This was not my mind. If it were my mind, I don't know how I arrived to that point and how I interrupted my previously recorded program of flotsam and jetsam.
Right. That's great.
So that was something I just wanted to share with that. But
I love it. Thank you for sharing that. That's
fantastic. Yeah, my pleasure. I guess, you know, one of the things in my questions, I've been a seeker in dream yoga for a very long time, probably half my life. First book I picked up, I was 20, and it was Chogyam Namkhay Norbu's book on dream yoga. And that really set me on the path.
Yep.
And having said that, you know, I have applied these practices, and maybe like Gillian, I feel like I experience a lot of detritus. I am aware, like if I eat a late meal, I will dream of vampires and zombies. And I know that this is just my body's expression and my mind's manifestation of not having completely digested a meal. But I am curious. You started today talking about second, kind of creating this intention into the space of dreaming. And I find that I somehow, when I do, whether it's the red ah or the white ah at the heart or wherever it is, I lose sight of that and I become very porous And I feel like it's a porous meaning. I don't feel like I have a directive in the dream space. And I'm wondering how you can speak to this. I haven't completed reading your book, Dream Yoga, but I figured this is a question and answer, and I would
ask a question. So Luke, say more when you mean directive, like some way to activate the dream practice, or what do you mean?
To activate. Recently I had some brain scans done in the waking life, and it showed that I had a lot of what he called dreamy quality in waking state. He's like, I don't know if you're a meditator, but your EEG is showing just a lot of what he called like theta and alpha. And he was talking about it in terms of, he's like, it's a very dreamlike quality. He's like, it might be difficult for you to focus on things. And I was like, yeah, but I'm very present. And I think, being in the world, I am very, I've spent and devoted my professional life to being present with others in the body through breathing, through manual therapy. But in my dream state, I feel like I am kind of effusive rather than having a directive or being able to stay with the meditation that I bring in.
Well, this is really, really good comments, Luke, and thank you for sharing it. There's so many ways to engage, somewhat akin to the earlier statement. There's so many ways to engage the nocturnal mind in the sleep, dream, and even liminal space, right? And so even though there is some kind of organizational template with the dream yoga practices and in my cartography, these nine stages and all that kind of stuff, there's a tremendous kind of validity to that skeleton. But that doesn't necessarily mean everything should be kind of force-fed into that particular framework, right? And so this is where it actually becomes helpful to work with someone who can guide you a little bit more specifically, because that doesn't in any way negate the validity of what you're already working with in your dream experience, see? And so if you're feeling it like this translucency, this porosity kind of thing, I mean, that's really quite beautiful. I mean, that in itself is a consequence of your opening. And so does that mean that you're somehow deficient in classic sleep and dream yoga curriculums? Yeah, I'm not so sure about that. Again, this also is part of this larger embrace. This is the way I roll with these things. That even though there are, yes, these particular classic stages, there are all these sorts of things. I kind of like that. I think there's some level to that level, some credibility to that level of articulation. Because otherwise, fundamentally, when you're working with a nocturnal mind, almost by definition, it's fuzzy and bewildered and unfocused and just all over the effing place, right? So having some kind of frameworks and what that can be actually very helpful. But that doesn't mean you're somehow a lesser practitioner if your particular style is communicating in the bandwidth that you seem to be sharing. But this is something that gets a little bit tricky to summarize in quick, tidy sound bites, bullet points in a context like this. This is something that would warrant a little bit more fleshing out with like, what are you doing in your day? What are you doing around all these things? And then this experience could be a little bit more situated within that kind of context. So it's the blessing and curse of having any type of map, right? So don't let the map squeeze the territory.
Got it.
You have an experience, that's the territory. Is it benefiting you? Are you relating to your world? Are you becoming more kind? Hey, that's effing great. Does that mean you're somehow failing in dream yoga? I don't think so. This is where you have to, in my opinion, just kind of relax some of the boundaries around these nocturnal practices. And that's why, again, in my mapping, there's five of these suckers.
Yeah.
There's a way to really bring lucidity and awareness outside of these somewhat classic parameters. And to me, that just seems to make it a lot more workable, a little bit more playful. You're still engaged. These are a really lovely set of comments and questions, Luke. So basically, for purposes of time, I would just say carry on, maybe with a more celebratory attitude that something is being transformed, work with. And then, yes, it's helpful to be aware of the metrics and the so-called practices themselves, but don't let the map shrink the territory.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Yeah, welcome. Okay, Aiden. All right, this time a hard sob after you. Okay, bud.
All right. So I was just wondering, because I'm really new to this dream yoga stuff, but
beginner's mind is good mind.
So I can remember my dreams, right? And last night, I don't know, it was some sort of video I watched, but It was you gave like a link, and it was the prayer by Dujom Rinpoche. It was something. I don't know if you remember that, but I did that. Now, also, I did Amitabha practice because I resonate a lot with Amitabha. And yeah, and I dreamed of Amitabha last night.
Cool.
And we had a conversation, but it's really vague.
Beautiful.
So I was just wondering if you like had any practices for the day or nighttime.
For
recognizing the dream state.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, high five with Amitabha coming to say hi. That's really pretty cool. you know, the best thing you can do, again, if you're new to that whole business and the nightclub thing, in terms of like stuff I already have, you know, probably the Harbinger Press book, since Joy so graciously flashed that up there, the Lucid Dreaming Handbook. There's all kinds of stuff I riff on there, but I'll give you a couple things here. And then again, if you are a member of the nightclub platform, I don't know how many webinars we have specifically on this topic, but outside of intentionality, by far the next best thing you can do if you don't have a meditation practice, that's really the best thing you can do, because lucidity is a code word for mindfulness, awareness. A lucid dream is a mindful dream, and it's an aware dream. And basically, the more you develop lucidity towards the contents of your mind during the day, what is found now is found then, the more you'll develop lucidity towards the contents of your mind as it displays itself at night. And so this is why, in fact, my friend Benjamin Baird, Alyssa, I don't know if we still have that study. He's a neuroscientist out of Austin now, Texas. He's doing a study. He asked me to send it out, and I've been trying to do that to whatever extent I can. Basically trying to substantiate the claim, which I've informally substantiated for decades, that meditators have more lucid dreams. So he's actually doing a study on this. So basically, intentionality, increased meditation, and then all the different lucidity techniques, of which there are dozens, those are really helpful. The other last one that I'll say, and then I'll let it go, is the daytime practice of illusory form. That's what my whole book, Dreams of Light, was all about. This is basically very simply saying as often as you can throughout the day, this is a dream, this is a dream. You know, challenging the status of this reality and basically seeing the dreamlike qualities here. Those three, intentionality, meditation, lucid form, are huge. And then outside of that, my friend, oh my gosh, it's too much to say. The prospective memory practices, state checks, dream signs, there's just a whole battery. And that's kind of what I've been riffing on for years. But just to give you something to go on, intentionality, strengthen that. If you don't have a meditation practice, I highly recommend you engage in that. That's huge. That's a dream yoga thing. It's not so much a lucid dreaming thing. And then to even go a step beyond that, work with the practices of illusory form. I mean, these are really, really powerful gigs. I mean, when I did these, you know, in a really long retreat, I mean, non-lucidity doesn't stand a chance. I mean, you do this kind of triple-barreled approach, you're going to blow the doors wide open to lucidity. Okay, bud?
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. So let me just go through a couple of these real quick before we go, because I haven't eaten in like 10 hours and I'm getting quite hungry. So yes, from Karen, what are the five? Yeah, these are called the five niyamas or orders. It's not five parts of karma. They're called the five niyamas, N-I-Y-A-M-A, the five orders, uta. I think it's UTA or UTU, UTO, UTO Niyama, that's basically physics. Bija, B-I-J-A, literally means seed, that's basically biology, genetics. Chitta, C-H-I-T-T-A in Sanskrit, means mind, that's basically psychology. Dharma Niyama, that's basically what it sounds like, the order of the Dharma. There's a ton to say about that. And then the last one is Karma Niyama. Causality, as it's basically brought about through behavioral consequences. That's what karma is about. Don't forget the other four. Okay, what do you think of the Monroe Institute? I don't know much about it, Pramdas. I don't know much about it. I know a lot of people have done it. They've gotten a lot of really cool things out of it. I don't know much about it, so I'm going to refrain from any comments. From David, the link that Dr. J and, oh yeah, so that's down here below. That's a New York Times thing that Jerry put up. There we go. Oh, last one here. A former student with whom I've had ongoing conversations keeps referring to himself as delinquent. It took some time for me to understand that what he is describing might be best called divine madness. The meaning of this, his word choice came to me in a dream. Okay. He is noticing that he doesn't quite fit into the social, professional, intellectual conventions of our time. He's a liminal being then. High five. Good for him. Liminal being. He's coming off a divorce and is about to enter the Navy. Okay. I've been guiding him through this transition. And I wonder if you have some good readings that could help him appreciate his encounter with the unconventional. Yes. Read Jeffrey Kripal. Start with his book, The Flip. Jeffrey's got a ton written on this. Listen to my two podcasts with Sean Esbjorn Hargens on Edge of Mind platform. This guy's amazing with his riffs on Excel studies. That alone will definitely give you enough to work on. Read the book Extraordinary Knowing by Elizabeth Myers. I mean, there's so much here, but Jeffrey Kripal really rocks this world. His sense that this isn't all there is. Yeah, no kidding, right? That what he is calling delinquency may be his encounter with what is, maybe, I can't say. He's been having lucid dreams, and now reality doesn't seem as solid as it is. Yes, as it used to be, because it's not. Reality is not solid. It's a dream. Lucidity and sleep is translating into lucidity and so-called waking consciousness. High five. Bravo. Tell him that he's really on, spot on. Tell him to be brave, courageous. Be fearless in his liminality. Liminal beings are beings that don't fit. And they're more in contact with reality than people who do fit. So just to give him a big hug, tell him whatever he's doing something right. As we here know, it is deep at the deep end, and I would like to send my former student and friend a few lifelines. There you go. Jeffrey Kripal, Sean Esbjorn Hargens, Elizabeth Lloyd Meyer, I think, Extraordinary Knowing. There's so much stuff out there. Okay, here we go. We're done. I think we're done. Yay, gotta go. See you, bye. Nice to see everybody. Sorry, I was a little speedy today. I was traveling the whole day. So I get a little speedy when I get back from all that sort of thing. But as we also do here, we dedicate the merit. Always remember, we're not doing this so much for ourselves. We're doing this for others. We're doing it for the world. Don't forget that. And so as a way to do that, we gather whatever merit, whatever brownie points we've accumulated here. We just spread it out to the entire world, helping all the beings, sentient beings, the planet itself, which needs so much help. Don't ever forget that. Otherwise, what we're doing here, it's irrelevant. None of the stuff matters at all. Zip, none. If we can't help each other, if we can't help the world, what we're doing here is utterly, completely irrelevant. So always remember, you're doing this so you can clean up your stuff so you can help others. That's the whole point. That's the only game in town. So with that said, if you want to unmute yourself and turn on your camera, we do this geeky little kind of group hug. Love you all. See you. Come join us in our happiness program. I'm going to be happy for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.